We were speaking last time about R, Luther's last years. We noticed how in his last years he had much trouble with his health, but he pushed on in spite of it, turning out a great amount of work, occasionally becoming quite discouraged at one time when he found the women were wearing very low-necked dresses and other things, and Wittenberg was discouraged greatly, and he decided he just couldn't stand it anymore, and he left town, so he'd never come back. But friends went after him and persuaded him, and he came back. And he continued his work there. And then we were just ready to mention number five, Luther's death, at the end of the hour. Now, it's very interesting to see how active he was right to the very end. In 1546 is when he died. I believe I've mentioned to you before, but I want to stress it, that there are certain dates in this period that are important for us to have in mind. They are important because we are looking now at, four different great movements in the time of the Reformation, which are interrelated and yet separate. So separate that if we would take up a year and see what happened in Germany, what happened in Switzerland, what happened in England, and what happened about the papacy in detail, we get all confused and mixed. It's much better to take these four separately. That's the way we're doing it. Nevertheless, in order to understand them properly, especially the last three, you have to know about where they fit in to each other. And therefore, the main date is very important to have in mind. I mentioned last time, I'd like you to remember 1483, the date of Luther's birth, just because that gives you an idea about how old he was at each period of his life. And it's easy for an American to remember that because it's just 9 years before Columbus made his great voyage. Then everybody should know, of course, October 31st, 1517, the date when Luther put his feet on the trip. And then, of course, 1519 is the Leipzig debate, and 1520 is Luther's three great works, Reformation works, and then 1521 appears before the Emperor of Worm, and here's the Wartburg. And then there are some important things I've mentioned with dates in between that and 1530, but the next really outstanding date is 1530, the Augsburg Confession, one of the documents which has been referred to as much as almost any human document in the last 400 years. And therefore, it's very important we know the date of that, 1530. And of course, you know the events that surround it. Well, then, you have an idea of the events during the remaining 16 years of Luther's life, but remember the date, please remember the date of his death, which is 1546. Now, 1546, then, Luther was actively working, trying to overlook his health problem. In his earlier life, he had occasionally been laid up for weeks or months. In the latter part of the life, he had constant pains and miseries of different kinds, but they rarely incapacitated him more than a few hours at a time. And he was right back at his vigorous activity. And in 1546, he heard of two brothers, counts of the area in which he had been born, some distance north of Wittenberg. He had been born in the little town of Eisleben, and these were the counts of the area of Mansfield, which included this little town of Eisleben. It's interesting that though most of his life was spent in other places, he was born and died in the same town, in Eisleben. And he went up there to try to reconcile these two counts who were having a very vigorous dispute. They both claimed to be followers of the Reformation, but they were having a great difference of opinion, and Luther went up there and tried to find out what were the little matters on which they were arguing which didn't matter and get them to see it, what were the important things of difference, and let's see who's right in each of them. Let's get them to change their attitude toward each other. He went up there and spent several days working with them and felt that he had them quite completely reconciled. And he was very happy about that. On the way, after he got there, on February 1st, 1546, he wrote a letter to Melanchthon, in which he spoke rather frankly about his physical difficulties. In the course of the letter, he said, "A fainting fit overtook me on the journey. and also that disease which you are wont to call palpitation of the heart. I went on foot, overtaxed my strength, and perspired. Later, in driving, my shirt became cold with sweat. This made my left arm stiff. My age is to blame for the heart trouble and the shortness of breath. Now I am quite well again, though I do not know for how long. When even youth is not safe, age can little be trusted. Well, this letter which he wrote to Melanchthon showed to his wife, and she got quite disturbed. And she wrote him a letter in which she was very much worried about him. And he said, what on earth did Melanchthon show that letter to Katie for? It just gets her upset and excited. So he wrote her a letter on February 10th from Iceland. And he said to her, grace and peace in Christ, most holy lady doctoress. I thank you kindly for your great anxiety which keeps you awake. Since you began to worry, we've almost had a fire at the inn just in front of my door. And yesterday, due to your anxiety, no doubt, a stone nearly fell on my head, which would have squeezed it as a trap does a mouse. For in my bedroom, lime and cement had dribbled down on my head for 2 days until I called attention to it, and then the people of the inn just touched the stone as big as a bolster and 2 spans wide, which thereupon fell out of the ceiling. For this I thank your anxiety, but the dear angel protected me. I fear that unless you stop worrying, the earth will swallow me up or the elements will persecute me. Do you not know the catechism and the creed? Pray and let God take thought, as it is written, cast thy burden on the Lord, and he shall sustain thee, both in Psalm 55 and other places. I am, thank God, well and sound, except that the business in hand disgusts me, and Jonas takes upon himself to have a bad leg, where he hid himself on a trunk. People are so selfish that this envious man would not allow me to have the bad leg. God bless you. I will willingly be free of this place and return home if God will. God will. Amen, amen, amen. Your holiness' obedient servant, Martin Luther. That's the letter which he wrote her on February 10th, and on February 14th he wrote one more brief letter to her, which was the last letter that he ever wrote. On February 16th he drew up a treaty between the brothers, and they agreed to it, and he felt that very happy that he had made this reconciliation between them. But then on that very day, he felt faintness and pressure around the heart, somewhat relieved by warm towels and other treatments, and fell ill in the night. They called his friend, and it seemed quite evident that there was nothing that could be done for him. And so about 2 o'clock in the morning of February 18th, it was rather evident that death was approaching to him. He suddenly had a stroke that night, and as he was losing consciousness, one of his friends, this man Jonas, as he referred to in the other letter, called out loud to him, Reverend Father, will you stand steadfast by Christ and the doctrine you have preached? The dying man answered, yes. The last word he spoke distinctly, though the friends around him thought they made out one more murmur, who hath my word shall never see death. Now last year, the Xerox company put on the television a little play, which I understand had been shown before in other ways, a play which was on the life of Martin Luther, which made much of his physical ailments as if they had a lot to do with his youth, to his life, and in the last part of it showed him with somebody saying, how glad I am that you took the stand you did and showed us the truth, and his saying, well, I hope I was right, and showed something like that as his last words, as if he had doubt at the end of his life as to whether whether he had been right or not in his life activity. Well, there's absolutely no evidence whatever that toward the end of Luther's life he had any doubt that the Lord had been leading him and that the stand that he had been taking was right. And as you notice, at the very end of his life, he was asked this question, do you stand by the doctrine you've preached and the stand you've taken? And he said, yes, and that was his last word. And so it is truly wicked that people will so utterly misrepresent history, you know, for their own selfish purposes and for their wicked purposes. Martin Luther was a human being who made mistakes, as all human beings do. And when a man of such tremendous ability makes mistakes, his mistakes do harm 1,000 times more than when an ordinary person makes mistakes. But They should be balanced against the great good that he did, such as no one else of his generation would have been able to accomplish, and the tremendous results that have followed from his activities ever since. He was one of the great Christians of the world's history. And even from a viewpoint of simply of secular history, apart from thought of Christianity, he was one of the influences that have molded the world. There would not be over 10 at most people in the history of the world who have had as great an influence or as great an importance in what they did in affecting world history as Martin Luther did. But we say more about different details regarding his work a little later in something of a summary. Now we want to notice what happened right after that. One of his letters told how the emperor's troops had been in a certain area, and he'd had to go around it and getting up to Eisleben, which reminds us of the fact that right at this time, the emperor was beginning his great push. And so we have S, capital S, the emperor's success and failure. The emperor's success and failure. And number one on this, the emperor's desires. I want to remind you again of the attitude of Charles V. An attitude which was a great desire to have one empire and one church. He believed that there should be a unified church. He had been brought up by the man who later became Pope Adrian, who had strongly stressed the Romanist teaching, including those great central doctrines of Christianity on which Roman Catholicism and Protestantism had agreed, but also stressing the superstitious additions which had come up in the Middle Ages. And Charles inclined to accept what he had been taught. His own activity was mainly in the field of politics or of military activity. But he was quite thoroughly satisfied that what the church decided was right, but his great central desire was to have a unified church, as he had a unified empire. And if the Pope had been willing to put aside their selfish desires for their personal aggrandizement or for the aggrandizement of the power coming from Rome, and to join with the emperor to destroy this movement, it could easily have been destroyed at its start or in its early days. But the Reformation went on for 20 years before the Pope realized how important it was. And most of them in those days were more interested in their fear that the emperor would get too much power than they were in their fear that the Protestant movement would be cut away some of their domain. They knew that Wycliffe had led a great Reformation, but it had been completely wiped out. And while there still remained a few hundred people scattered through England who were reading Wycliffe's works and greatly interested in his teachings, there was no longer anyone of influence or standing supporting Wycliffe, and in the previous century, at least 20 had been burned at the stake for following Wycliffe. They knew that John Huss had led a great movement against the superstitions of the Middle Ages, and Bohemia was still standing by the teachings of John Huss at this time, but that was a country pretty far away. Remind you of how Chamberlain said in 1938, to think that we here in England would be digging trenches, preparing for war, for the possibility of war on account of what happens in a little country off in Central Europe that most of us can't even pronounce the name of. That was his feeling about the lack of importance of events in Czechoslovakia. But of course he soon found that England was tremendously affected by what happened in Czechoslovakia. But Czechoslovakia, the tendency of people those days and today is to think, oh, well, that's way off there. What do we care? What happens there? Well, in Czechoslovakia, the great bulk of the people followed John Huss until 1621, when this is 100 years after the time we're now looking at, when the emperor's forces succeeded in conquering the land and putting an end to the teachings of John Huss. And that country, which had probably been 90% followers of Huss in 1610, by 1630, his teachings were absolutely forbidden in the land, And by 1700, 98% of the people in the land were Roman. And 2% kept their little Hussite Bibles and read them in secret in fear of their lives. But there were 2% that preserved them through a period of 300 years. Until when finally Czechoslovakia fell into an even worse tyranny in the late 40s, and they took Jan Masaryk and threw him out the window for his opposition to them. One of these Hussite Bibles was found on his table where he had been reading it when the communists seized him and threw him out the window. And so there was a little group that preserved the knowledge in Czechoslovakia through those 300 years. But most of the people had no chance after 1621 to hear biblical teaching and were simply carried away from it. And so the Pope felt, well, this is often that country in Central Europe, it's true, but it's a large number of people, but it will disappear, as it did 100 years later when it was attacked by the emperor of that time and destroyed. But he thought this is another movement like those. Probably like Wycliffe, it will disappear in a few years. Maybe like the other movement, it might take a part of Germany for a while, eventually it'll be reconquered. What I'm more worried about is that this Emperor Charles V is going to get too much power. And so he was always conspiring the different popes with the King of France, who also was afraid the emperor had too much power, conspiring to cut down Charles's power, and Charles had to fight them half his life. And then he had to spend a great deal of energy defending Europe against the Turks, which would have destroyed all of them if it had not been for Charles's efforts to hold them back. Of course, he had more to lose than any of the rest, because his land was bigger than all the rest of them put together. But between these things, Charles was prevented from making a great attack until this time. But now, when he led his armies right to the gates of Paris and had France at his feet, he made the Peace of Crécy, which didn't take anything away from France, forgave them for all their efforts against him, only on condition that they do not interfere with his attempt to destroy Protestantism, and that they hold back until he completes his plan to put an end to Protestantism. And so he now, in starting about 1545, he had his hands free at last after more than 20 years of aiming at this. And so number two is the Schmalkaldic War. Yes? I've seen it spelled two different ways. I'm not really sure which is the preferred way. Crepy, and I've seen it with an S in. I'm not sure which is correct. It's a small town where the peace was made. Yes? Eisleben. Eisleben. A little town which in itself is a little important, but it's very interesting that it's the place where Luther was born and the place where he died. So he went to school way over in Eisenach, 150 miles away. He was most of his life was spent either at Erfurt or at Wittenberg. He was very rarely there, but he was there for birth and there for death. So it makes the town of historic interest, though not intrinsically of any great importance. This word Schmalkaldic, I don't think is of great importance for you. It's the name of the place where they made an alliance. The Protestants made an alliance 15 years before this, nearly 20 years, to stand together to defend themselves against the emperor. And when these folks who had made this alliance were attacked by the emperor, this war has been called the Schmalkaldic War. Yes? Yes, S-C-H-M-A-L-K-A-L-D-I-C. S-C-H-M-A-L-K-A-L-D-I-C. The Schmalkaldic War. Now this war, the emperor did not reveal his purposes. He had in the previous few years been getting a group of Protestant theologians, a group of Romanists together to have a discussion to see why they couldn't get together. And they had each been trying to hold to their views and yet to express them in terms the others might be able to agree to. And so they had been working, trying to please the emperor, to work out formulas they could get together, but each of them interpreted them in his own way. And they couldn't find a formula they could agree on. They found formulas that they came pretty close to agreeing on, but only if they interpreted them in diametrically opposite ways. And Charles saw that this method of trying to bring unity was not working, but he pretended that he thought it was doing well and urged them to keep on with it and hid his intention. He got the Pope and the King of France to agree not to interfere, not to attack him in the rear while he's fighting against the Protestants. He secretly made negotiations with them, and then he looked about to try to separate the Protestants. And Philip of Hesse, who was the greatest military leader among the Protestants, and the one who perhaps had the greatest intelligence and clearness of mind in trying to get them together, to work together, had that great unfortunate difficulty we mentioned, and for this reason many of the others looked askance at him, and Charles found in this an opportunity to separate them. Well, first he tried to get Philip of Hesse and John Frederick, the present elector of Saxony, the nephew of Frederick the Wise, the one who was important at the beginning of the Reformation. He tried to get the two of them to make an alliance with him which would break their relations with the other, and he failed in that. They both stood solidly by the Reformation. Then he gave that up and tried to get some others to join with him against them. And he found a weak spot in a man named Morris, M-A-U-R-I-C-E in the English spelling of the man's name. Most of these names have been anglicized. That is, the most important names usually people translate into their own language, while the less important they have to try to keep in the original language. But Morris was the nephew of George, Duke George, who's been Luther's great enemy. You remember in 1539, when Duke George died and did his best to keep Romanist control of his land had been permeated with Luther's teachings. And his brother was a strong supporter of Luther, and his brother Henry had welcomed Luther to preach in Leipzig, and the people throughout the Ducal Saxony, as they called it, those people were strongly for Luther, and the whole thing went over quickly once George was gone. But Henry, his brother, was quite an old man, and he did not live very long after that, and was succeeded by his young son, Morris. And Morris had been brought up with the Lutheran teaching. He was not a man who had faced the issues and turned from the old superstitions. He was a man who had been brought up in the Lutheran teaching, and he was firmly believed the Lutheran teaching was right. He wanted to support it, but he also wanted to gain glory for himself, advance for himself. There was in him that which is in every human being, in every Christian. There is the striving within him between the desire to put God first and the desire to seek your own advancement, your own pleasure, your own money, your own thing, that which pleases you. And nobody can tell to just where the two separate and how much of his activity is related to one, how much is related to the other. We have to pray the Lord to help us, to give us wisdom, and to give us determination to follow as he leads. But Morris hadn't gone through the struggle as Philip of Hesse had, as Henry his father had, as Frederick the Wise and his brother John had, but he wanted to follow Lutheranism, he wanted to support the Reformation, but he wanted to advance himself. And so Charles was able to make negotiations with Morris, and he said, after all, look, you've got the two great cities of Saxony, you've got Dresden and Leipzig, and yet your cousin John Frederick, who just has these little towns down there to the south, hey, he says, well, he's the elector, and you don't have any right to be elector. Morris says, well, but he says, it's true, I've got the big cities, but he says, he's got the more territory than I have. Well, Charles says, you've got the big cities, and the city ought to have plenty of territory around it. Don't you think that the northern half of John Frederick's territory really ought to belong to you, and that you ought to be an elector? And so on. And, Henry said, Morris says now, he says, when Charles began criticizing Philip of Hesse, Morris said, well, he says, my wife is the daughter of Philip of Hesse. And he says, I've always found Philip in most things a very fine man, very clear mind on things. And, whoa, the emperor says, I wouldn't think of hurting Philip. But he says, I think that his power ought to be cut down a bit. And he persuaded Morus to secretly make an alliance with him. And one other Protestant prince further north, he made a similar arrangement. And so suddenly they struck, and here were Protestants on the side of the emperor. And they gave little excuses of reasons for the fight. And it wasn't a matter, of course, of Protestantism involved, because there were Protestants on both sides. So it's foolish to say it's Protestantism, isn't it? Even though those who knew the emperor knew that was his real purpose. But the result was that in a battle, the elector of Saxony was taken prisoner, and his army completely defeated. He was wounded and taken a prisoner. And Morus and the emperor said, I will transfer the electorship away from him and the northern 40% of his territory and give it to Morus, who has stood with me here. And he gave that to Morus. And then Morus said, well, now, he said, I've got all I want. And he said, you have succeeded in what you want. Now, he said, why should we keep on fighting? Why do these people keep on fighting? Well, Charles said, I have no desire to hurt any of them. So he said, I wish your uncle or your father-in-law, Philip of Hesse, would lay down his arms instead of keeping fighting. Well, Morus says, I'll talk to him. And he says, well, you promise you won't injure him in any way. You won't make him prisoner or anything if he surrenders. Oh, certainly not. He's your father-in-law. I wouldn't think of injuring him. So Morus talked to Philip, and Philip laid down his arms and surrendered. And immediately Charles said, you are under the ban of the empire for your wicked deeds, and cast him into prison, where he stayed 6 years, and where he was treated most cruel by his jailers. So Frederick, and so Charles had the Elector of Saxony in prison, and he had Philip of Hesse in prison. He had all of Germany at his feet, and now he could do just whatever he wanted. And if Charles had been able if Charles had realized the importance of the thing, and in 1521, when Luther was in the Wartburg, had marched with his army, he could have utterly destroyed Luther and everyone in Germany who had any interest in Luther's teaching, easily in 1520. In 1525, he could have done it, if the King of France had stuck by his promises instead of turning against him immediately once he got free, and if the Pope hadn't been knifing him in the back every chance he got. And in 1531, at the Diet of Augsburg, they had decided that the Protestant confession had been disproved by the Catholic theologians, and that after this date in 1531, that they were to all must accept the Romanist control or be destroyed. And if then they had carried that through, it would have been a harder job, much harder than it would have been in 1521. But there's no question but what it could have been done as completely as it was done in Czechoslovakia in 1621. Yes? No, John Frederick. John Frederick. Yeah, he was no longer elector, of course, he took that with him. But now, by this time, it was quite evident that Luther's works and those of his friends and the preaching of these people had been distributed all through Germany, that thousands of people had found peace in their souls, had found justification by faith in Christ, and turned away from the medieval superstition, and were devoted to the Reformation teaching. And the only way that you could now establish, simply say, everybody must be subject to the Roman Church, was to kill off half or two-thirds of the Germans. And the communists would have done that probably if it had been there. But this Charles was not quite that barbaric, and he, in addition, was not interested in trying to make everybody subject to the Pope. He wanted one church and one empire. He wanted the Pope for executive officer of it. But he felt that the theologians should get together and work out what the truth is, and then everyone should stand for it. And so Charles had for 20 years been trying to get the Pope to call a general council. That was when the papal legate came to Wittenberg here. Charles said, get all the Christians together, get their representatives to have a general council, decide what the truth is, and then we'll enforce it throughout Christendom. Well, the Pope knew how a general council in 1415 had deposed three popes and had picked one of themselves and had decreed that every 10 years thereafter there should be a general council and that the pope should merely be an executive officer. And the one thing the popes didn't want was a general council. And so they kept putting Charles off and putting him off and refusing to have the general council. But Charles kept pressing the pope to call a general council. And now they had a pope, Paul III, who realized the importance of the Reformation, who really wanted to do something vital about it. Of course, he also wanted to keep the emperor from getting too much power. But he was realizing the importance of this, and Paul agreed to hold a general council. And Charles said, have the general council in a German city. And so Paul called it in the town of Trent, which was about 2 miles inside the area where there were German-speaking people, but way south of the Alps. It's quite a distance into Italy today, is this town of Trent. But he called a general council to meet at Trent, and they sent invitations to the Protestant leaders as well as the Romanist leaders to come to the council. But by this time, the Protestant leaders had no longer had faith that a general council would decide the truth. They knew that the arrangement of this was such that the Pope would have control in it anyway. And so they refused to go to the council, to Charles's disgust. This happened before the beginning of the Small Celtic War. The council actually began just while the Small Celtic War was in progress. But now, therefore, number three is the interims. I-N-T-E-R-I-M-S. The interims. Charles had all of Europe, or all of Germany, all the German-speaking areas, Germany and Austria, and these whole areas that were under control of the emperor. He had them completely at his feet. But he wanted unity, and so Charles gave an edict. There must be an interim. And this interim means that we're going to get a unified religious system, which will be observed in the interim until a general council really decides what it ought to be. And so they call it an interim. But the interim, as Charles worked it out, pleased neither the Protestants nor the Romans. The Romanists said, what business does this emperor, this secular man, have to decide religious questions? Those should be decided by the pope and by the bishop, not by an emperor. And some of the Protestants said, well, the emperor is making a plan which is a sort of a compromise for the present. We have no power. We're completely physically at his mercy. Let's put up with this interim which he's establishing all through his domain. But then they found the interim was being enforced in the Protestant domain, while in the areas that were Romanist, they were allowing the Romanist ceremonies and everything go forward exactly as it was. In the Protestant areas, marriage of the clergy was being permitted, and they were having the communion with the laity partaking both of the bread and wine, not just of the bread, as was part of the superstition that had developed in the Middle Ages, which is kept to the present day in most parts of the Romanist church, that only that the priests drink all the wine and the people only eat the bread in the communion. Well, they were in the Romanist areas. They would punish any priest that married, and they would punish anyone who gave both the bread and wine. While in the Protestant areas, they were permitting it. But they were forcing them to use Latin in the services again instead of German, and the interim was very strongly on the Romanist side and made only superficial concessions to the Protestants. And so Morris refused to agree to the interim. He said, I believe in Luther's teaching, I believe in Protestant doctrines. He said, I cannot agree to my territory having to adopt this interim. Yes? Yeah, well, everybody felt it was unfair. But the The Romanists felt it was wrong to have the emperor make any changes in the religious situation, and the emperor, while theoretically the interim was to be in all his areas, he did not enforce it in the Romanist area. And then those Protestants, now I shouldn't have said the Protestants, because there were many of them who felt the whole thing was utterly wrong anyway, but those who were somewhat ready, as to go along with it. After all, the whole, it's made some concessions to us, and if we give something, they give something, we should go along with it. When they saw it was being enforced only against them, they tended to get pretty upset about it too. And Morris refused to have it in his domain, and so the emperor said, all right, we'll make a special interim for your domain. And so they got a hold of Melanchthon, and they asked Melanchthon what you think is absolutely essential. And Melanchthon, in writing the Augsburg Confession, had tried to make it as concessive as possible, holding clearly to Protestant doctrines on the main things, but making it as concessive as possible. And so he said, well, if you'll improve the interim by this and this and this, bring out clearly justification by faith, which the other hadn't denied, but it definitely had not taught. If you will do these things, he said, maybe we can get along with it. And so with Melanchthon's advice and Morris's insistence, they made a separate interim for Saxon, which they called the Saxon interim. So this was only in Morris's territory. And in the rest of the territory, they were to have the regular interim, but in the Romanist territory, they didn't enforce it. And it simply was not enforceable unless you did as the communists would have done, proceeded to kill those who were the ringleaders immediately against us, and to introduce spot control, seize people on suspicion, and do all that sort of thing as they do today, which enforces uniformity of thought in a way that would have been impossible in those days without modern equipment, without listening devices and telegrams and all the means of spreading information that we have today. And so, through Germany, though it was forbidden to say anything against it, there began to circulate anonymous things criticizing the interim. A special coin was struck called the interim, and it said on the top of it, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And how could you attack people unless it was under a communist regime, how could you attack people for a thing like that? Who can object to that, scripture? And it just says interim. But of course the meaning of it is clear enough, that you shouldn't let the emperor say what you're going to believe religiously. But many of these anonymous things that were distributed went much further than that. There was one paper distributed which was a little catechism. It said, what part of speech is interim? An adverb. What is an adverb? The word of Satan linked to the word of God for the deceiving of souls. Another one gave a genealogy of the interim. Says, the interim says, my mother is the woman of Babylon, beauteous beyond measure, decked with purple, silver, and silk and gold. Kings and princes have dalliance with her. All their desire is for her. And the Protestant ministers were driven out of their churches, and the old bishops were coming back and taking over, and there was all this undercurrent against it, against the interim. But one city revolted, the city of Magdeburg in North Germany, M-A-G-D-E-B-U-R-G. We've already mentioned Magdeburg on two occasions before. Albert, before he came Archbishop of Mainz, had been Archbishop of Magdeburg. And it was in Magdeburg, some of you may remember, I mentioned that a weaver there stood by one of the monuments in the center of town and began singing Luther's hymns, and people gathered around, and when the city government tried to interfere, the people just stood up and changed the city government, and Magdeburg in the 20s had become a thoroughly Protestant city. It was an imperial city. Now in Magdeburg, the people revolted and refused to submit to the interim, and Charles commissioned Morris to go and reduce Magdeburg. And so Morris went with an army and surrounded Magdeburg and began to besiege it. Now, number four, Morris's reversal. The emperor thought it was very clever to get Morris, one of the Protestants, to lead the army that would reduce the Protestant city that was fighting against the interim. And that was a very clever scheme if he could have trusted Morris. But Morris had been pretty much upset when, instead of carrying out his promise not to mistreat Philip, he had cast Philip into prison where he still had been after nearly 6 years, and to have him mistreated there by his guards and his territory simply taken over. He was very much displeased by that. He was displeased by interference with the religious life of the people in Saxony, even though he'd been willing to say it doesn't affect our national security if he kills the people in the other areas and mistreats them. He was feeling very disappointed with the results of the way he had turned against his co-religionists. And so he began secretly making alliance with the king of France. And he sent messengers and asked the king of France to not interfere on the side of the emperor. And the king of France said, well, if you'll give me Alsace-Lorraine out of Germany, which had been German for 1,000 years before that, and if you will make certain concessions, certain areas and different things, he said, I will agree not to give the emperor any help or support, and I may even give you a little support. And he made arrangements secretly, and then all of a sudden, his army left Magdeburg, headed south, and the emperor had no idea there was any danger of this. Suddenly, in South Germany, he found Morris's army coming, and he had to get up and flee pell-mell across the Alps, down into Italy. And somebody said to Morris, isn't it too bad you didn't capture the emperor? If you'd gone a little bit faster, you would have had it. Morris says, I don't have a net big enough to hold such a big bird as that. And he didn't want to capture the emperor. He'd have been in a position where he just wouldn't know what to do if he'd actually had him a prisoner. But here, he had freed Germany from the emperor. He fled south, and the emperor had lost his control over Germany. And it was evident that his whole life objective was destroyed. And it was necessary to recognize that there were now two religions in Christendom, instead of one. And there's no knowing what Morris might have gone on to do. He was a man of great ability, a man of sincere Protestant conviction, though he did allow his personal desires to override them to some extent here. But in one of the battles, Morris was killed. And so his career ended while he was quite young. But the electorate had been given to him and continued in his family ever after, and the greater part of Saxony now belongs to his family, the new electors of Saxony. So number 5, the Peace of Passau, P-A-S-S-A-U. The Peace of Passau in 1552, after having had Germany in his hands for about 5 years, the emperor found that it was too late. What he could have done 20 years earlier, if his hands had been free, was now impossible. He had to recognize facts as they were. And so the Peace of Passau agreed that in each territory there should be, for the time being, the local officials should decide on the religion of the territory. And it gave them what the Diet of Spires had given on a temporary basis. It made that a permanent condition. But, of course, it was necessary to make a final peace treaty that would settle matters, and the emperor couldn't quite bring himself to personally participate in that to see what had been the central desire of his life destroyed. And so, number 6, the emperor's resignation. The emperor resigned as a Duke of Burgundy, turned it over, that is, the Netherlands area, Holland, Belgium, northern France. He turned it over to his son, Philip. He resigned as emperor, turned it over. He tried to get the empire to take his son Philip, and they refused to take Philip as his successor. But he got his brother Ferdinand. His brother Ferdinand made emperor after him. His brother was quite a bit younger. His brother had represented him very often at the various sides. And then he resigned as king of Spain and went into a monastery where he spent the next 2 or 3 years trying to work on clocks And the story, which I don't know if it's true or not, the story that's told is that one time, as when the emperor just couldn't get the various clocks to all keep time together, he said, "My," he says, "I spent my whole life trying to make people think the same way, and I can't even make the clocks think the same way." Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but the story was told at the time. But another story told at the time is that the emperor looked back and said, "Oh, it warmed in 1521 when I had Luther right in my hand. Why didn't I burn it like the emperor did John Huss?" And probably his thoughts went from one direction to the other. His life work was ruined. He could have accomplished what he wanted if he'd done it earlier, on the one hand. On the other hand, he had done his very best to make people think alike and think the way he said, and he had not succeeded. And he, after two or three years there, he died. I think I told you about what happened at his death, about the two views that were presented. I think I mentioned that once before. But that fits in more at a later period than here, so I'll repeat that again at a later period. But we go on to, that was S, wasn't it? T, the Religious Peace of Augsburg. In 1555, at Augsburg, a treaty was made. Ferdinand, representing the emperor, his resignation had not yet fully taken effect, but Ferdinand, rather than Ferdinand, his brother, led the Protestant, the Romanist leaders, and they met with the Protestant leaders after the Peace of Passau. Philip had been released and John Frederick had been released, of course. Now they met the Protestant leaders, and the Protestant leaders asked that everyone in Germany be given freedom to believe in Protestant teaching, everyone in the empire, and Ferdinand would not agree to that. And they had a long argument, but Ferdinand said, "I will agree to let the nobles, to let the kings, to let the main city have freedom, the imperial city, but not just every individual. If a count of a territory is a Romanist, he has a right to insist all these people be." And they wanted peace now. They didn't want continued war. And so they agreed, but they said, "He shall not have power to kill the people there that differ with him." He said, "All right, we'll put that in. He may not kill the people who differ with him. He must allow them to migrate. But he can order them. He can give them a certain number of days to get out of his territory. But he must let them freely go." And so that was in the agreement, that a Romanist count or duke or leader shall say, "This is my territory. Only Romanist teaching is here. Everyone must follow it in the territory, but he cannot kill people for refusing to submit. He must allow them freely to leave and to go to another territory." And then Ferdinand said, "But in your territories, of course, anyone who wants a Romanist service must be free to hold." And they said, "Oh no, if you won't allow belief in your territories, we must have the right of having Protestant teaching only in our territories." And so he agreed to it. Each count, each leader, should have that right. Except, they said, the imperial city. In those, the city may decide what is to be the dominant religion, but in them, if it's a Protestant city, Romans must not be interfered with in having holding Romanist views if they desire. And so that was put in it. There were now two recognized religions in the empire. And it was illegal to persecute a person, except you could force them out of your territory, but illegal to imprison them or persecute them for holding either one of these views. But there were only two recognized. You must either follow the Pope, accept the Romans' teaching, or you must accept the Augsburg Confession. Well, John Calvin signed the Augsburg Confession. He said, "I agree with everything in the confession. I wish it went a bit further than it does." But he says, "I accept everything in it." And Queen Elizabeth of England, when the Pope wanted to excommunicate her, they said, "Oh no," they said, "she accepts the Augsburg Confession. You cannot do that. That is permitted." And so when the Pope finally excommunicated Queen Elizabeth of England in the Bull of Excommunication, he said she had partaken of the blasphemous mysteries of Calvin, and therefore she must be excommunicated. You had a question? Yeah? The imperial cities could determine their religion, but they must give power to Romans within their city. If the city is 90% Protestant, they can't tell Romans, you have to get out. They must permit them to hold their own church within the city. In the other territories, the territories that are controlled by a duke or a count or king, he can say what the religion is. People must either follow it or get out. But he's not supposed to imprison. Yes?
Were there any Roman imperial cities?
I don't believe there were. I think all the imperial cities had adopted this prostitute. But at least all the important ones had that for sure. There was one other thing in it, which became a great bone of contention later. Quite a few areas had previously been under control of bishops or archbishops, who acted as secular rulers of a territory. Quite a few territories were thus controlled. And in these territories, in a number of cases, the archbishop or bishop or head of the Teutonic Knights or whatever the organization was that controlled the territory had become a prophet and had simply changed it into a secular dukedom. And kept the property, kept the control, but changed it over as the people of the territory desired that he should. And now they said, hereafter, they said, any territory which belongs to the church, to a division of the church, to a bishop, to an archbishop, to an abbot, somebody like that, if he becomes a Protestant, he cannot take the property or take the territory. The territory that belongs to an ecclesiastical organization must continue to belong to the Roman Church. If this was done after 1552, but of course all the done before, they recognized. Well, now this made great disagreement later on, because there were other cases like this later. But this was the religious peace of Augsburg. It recognized Lutheranism. Two religions recognized. Now, they didn't call it Lutheranism. Luther would have been horrified at anybody calling himself Luther. Luther always said, follow the Bible, don't follow me. He always said that. He would have been horrified at the thought of his name being used for a church. And the name was not thus used for another 30 years. But it was what was subsequently called Lutheran, so it's not erroneous for us to use the term now. Yes?
I believe that the first of the class on Constitution, you were saying that John Huss was in the 1600s.
No, John Huss was burned at the stake in 1415. But the people of Czechoslovakia, the overwhelming mass of them, followed his teaching, despite armies that went to try to defeat them and to destroy it. And they followed it until 1621, when the army of the Austrian Emperor overcame Czechoslovakia and made it thereafter a crime to follow Huss's teaching. Thank you for calling attention to that. I want to have that clearly in mind. And these things are very easy to flip. There's a great many details that aren't so important, but there's some like that one that are very important. So I'm very glad to have called my attention. Any questions regarding it? Well, we will continue there tomorrow morning.